Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. This is now the 14th night and there are four streams tonight. In 2 hours it'll be Baba Kate, then Kiwi Off-Gridder, then The Prudentialist. But first, I'm here with a friend of mine who I've known for several years now. He has a good presence on Telegram and he is a pagan, quite an ardent pagan, but also a linguist and a general expert on quite a few different topics, which we might touch on here. And his name is Whiteyard. Welcome to Millennial. And tell me if I've mispronounced that.
No, you've finally got it right.
Whiteyard. Okay.
Yeah, that G can slip people up, but it's pronounced like a Y.
Yes. Okay. So, well, why don't you briefly, just for the sake of setting the laying the ground here, to talk briefly about paganism and how you got into that? Because people will wonder, and I think people do wonder, how does that enter someone's life? How does it? How do they take to it? And you know, I'm not a pagan myself, but it is an interesting topic. So why don't you talk about that? And first, briefly introduce yourself.
Well, my name is Whiteyard. I joined Telegram a few years ago. Initially, when I first started in these circles, I was, I think I was just posting various information and infographics on Instagram among friends and people like that, trying to red pill them. Then I came across Telegram. It seemed like a very good format and a good site to join, so I did. And it was a it acts like a very good format, like a diary. I can I tend to have quite erratic and very scattered thoughts, which I'm still trying to piece together into a very coherent and formative way. And Telegram was a very good site to join and finally put things into some sort of order. So I seem to do treat Telegram like it's almost like a form of a diary or some sort of blog where I can piece my thoughts together and see what seems to gel.
Yeah, it is a really nice format. I took to it quite quickly. At some point, it just sort of clicked that this is really good. At first, yeah. I was a bit baffled by it, but yeah, I like it a lot. So, why don't you tell people about paganism?
Well, paganism, its name itself, is a bit of a disparaging term. Essentially, it just means those who live in the countryside, in comparison to the much more learned and urban new religion of Christianity, which was essentially the something that was brought about as a fusion between Judaic history and religion, along with the Greek attitude towards philosophy and spirituality. And this sort of Hellenic Judaic fusion is what gave birth to Christianity, and that kind of centralized a particular worldview, which was quite universal in its aspect. And that's something we'll touch on later in this talk. But in contrast to that, basically anything that wasn't that was viewed as paganism or heathen. Essentially, it was what the native people of any part in the world continued to practice independently of this new cult that was being brought to their shores. So, essentially, its term is pretty much like when Jews call people goy. It's like that sense of other compared to their own centralization, and in the same way. Pagan is it is that other, but it can refer to anything. The native spiritual practices of various peoples of Europe, whether that's Germanic, whether it's Celtic, whether it's Roman or Greek, Slavic, even the practices of Japanese Shintoism, that would be pagan. The tribal practices of Africans, that will also be pagan. Of ancient Egyptian polytheism, that's paganism. And it's it's not just polytheism. It could be referring to the shamanism that's practiced among the Samis of Finland and Alaska as well. Essentially, anything that seems to emerge naturally among a people's folk soul, bottom up rather than imposed upon them top down, could be classed as pagan in that respect.
Right. Okay. Sorry, go on.
Sorry. Well, when I came to paganism, I'd been an atheist for many years. I was very critical of Christianity in my past because it just seems the sort of thing that goes hand in hand with atheism. But that's something that nowadays in the spiritual crisis that we're suffering in the West seems less desirable to do. But in that time, I really got deeply into reading biblical scripture, into archaeology, and essentially just trying to deconstruct and dismantle this whole wall of Christianity. But because of that, essentially left this very nihilistic void. I'd already deconstructed and dismantled Christianity. I didn't believe its whole worldview, its history, any of its claims to be rooted and anchored within real-time history. I didn't believe that to be true. And because of that, you feel that, well, what spirituality is there? And a lot of people who would call themselves pagans were very leftist, for what I could see, almost as if they were believing it out of spite towards Christianity rather than finding some sort of spiritual nourishment in it. Almost like it was a sort of antithesis to it rather than being something in itself. But because of this, it was difficult for me to find any form of belief. I was trying to over-rationalize the world, and when you're trying to over-rationalize things, belief doesn't come naturally. But I do think that's one of the main factors that that finally made it click with me and make sense was the realization that that these spiritual truths that I believe in are timeless. It doesn't need to be anchored within real-time history, as Christianity lays claim to. It doesn't need to occur in real-time history. It doesn't need to have happened within living memory. It's something that's eternal and timeless. And I think because of that, it finally clicked with me. I was no longer trying to rationalize it. There was something that was external to this rationalization of spirituality, that was external to trying to find proof, trying to find evidence and things like that. So it was something that it finally clicked and made sense with me because it was outside of rationality. And that's when that belief and that feeling finally emerged.
I think that's a good way to put it, outside of rationality, because a lot of people, including myself, have struggled with this, trying to find religion, wanting religion, but not being able to persuade oneself of the veracity of our religion. because we are so accustomed to being, to thinking in those terms, thinking of rational reason, logic, and evidence, as Molyneux always says. Reason, logic, and evidence. But anyway, the and I think it can be a block. You know, it can prevent you from finding that what you're wanting. I mean, I know that a rationalist would say, "Well, that's what it's supposed to do." It's supposed to prevent you from believing in things that aren't true.
Yeah,
and that's what rationality is for. And so, when you say that religion is outside of rationality, I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think that in comparison to the point I made earlier about Christianity in that respect, I think Christianity plays both hands at the same time. It says that God has always existed along with Jesus, who was the Word in the beginning. So Like pagans claim, it's something that's always been there outside of time. But at the same time, Christianity roots itself in a in living memory, in real-time history. It happens in a particular place in the world at a particular time. And I think this sort of double hand gives it not only a very unique character in itself, but can be its own flaw as well, because that staking in real time history makes it a hypothesis. It makes it rational, and if that infrastructure of biblical history and archaeology, if everything that it roots itself to falls apart, if it turns out that, for example, Jesus never existed, or that Nazareth wasn't a real place until sometime after, or that Jesus was more of a mythical character who had been projected into living history. Things like that undermine everything else, and it seems to collapse from there. And that leads to a further spiritual crisis of saying, well, how can I believe in something if it isn't rooted in... if it isn't rational, if it isn't within living history? And that becomes the problem, which I do feel that our native traditions, because they didn't need to be rooted within living history and were eternal and timeless, is the appeal that paganism and native beliefs have had in the modern age, not only as a reaction to the growing globalization of the world and the general over homogenization of the entire world into a global culture and cluster, which transcends race and particularism, but it seems to restore that particular nature. It seems to restore that difference in the world, which hasn't been drawn together in a unified singularity.
Well, and of course, a lot of Christians would say that that's one of Christianity's strengths, that it unites us all, that lets us see past our differences. It lets us see the bigger picture so that rivalries and feuds don't go on and on and on forever. But we have adherence to a higher principle of justice, that kind of thing. I mean, and I'm not even doubting that necessarily, but what would you say about that, the value of universalism, if any?
Well, I'd say look at the fruits of it. Look at the world around us. It pretty much shows the effects of that, of its fruits, which can be things like globalization and liberalism, communism, and things like that. And I wouldn't necessarily say that these are the particular fruits of Christianity. I don't believe that it can be singularly blamed for that. But I do think that it's tied to a much more long-lasting principle, which has caused this centralization and this globalization. And this particular force, the Faustian drive, is the topic that I wanted to discuss tonight.
Indeed, it's a good segue into it. Faustianism is often talked about in our circles as a great thing, the best of Aryan man. That drive that propels him forwards to do things and to build things and to conquer and expand and explore. You have got a different perspective on it.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Well, I'll start with a quote for Oswald Spengler from Man and Technics, because Oswald Spengler is one of the people who popularized the term of Faustianism in describing the particular natures of different peoples and how their natures impacts how they react in the world, how they behave, and how their particular... their own particular microcosm of the world is, and how their behaviour and how our culture is filtered through that particular worldview. And the character of Faust, for anyone who doesn't know, he was first popular in Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, but it was primarily through through Goethe's poem, part one and two of Faust. And Faust sold his soul to Mephistopheles, who was the devil, in return for infinite knowledge because of his constant desire of having flicked through every single form of knowledge, all forms of literature. And he felt exhausted that he'd understood everything, but still felt that there was more to get. And this sort of craving for infinite knowledge that you can never ever be full, you can never be complete, you always have to keep striving for more and more to conquer infinite space. This is what the Faustian drive is that Spengler saw, particularly for Northern Europeans. And it seems to reflect in our particular nature and how we behave. And of course, many of our great achievements, our conquering of various nations of the world, our constant drive to ascend to the mountains of the world, to even to conquer parts that are uninhabited and completely worthless just because we can, like the Antarctic. And that was a great achievement for us to conquer the Antarctic, to map and chart the entire world, and to understand everything we can, and even the drive of going into space. And this seems to be a sort of meme within the right-wing circles of saying, "Oh, if it wasn't for." For a particular ethnic groups, we could be reaching for the stars, and we could be conquering and colonizing Mars. But there's a question of why? How would that benefit us? It's a great achievement to say yes, we've done it, but at the same time, at what cost would it have done to us to do that? We live on a very beautiful planet. We're expending all the resources there to over-industrialise things, tearing down all the beautiful woodland, rainforests, and just turning everything into a an industrial plastic wasteland. But back to the Faustianism thing. It seems to be a tragedy in man, and this is what Spengler describes in Man and Technics. The history of mankind as a whole is tragic, but the sacrilege of and the catastrophe of the Faustian are greater than all others, greater than anything. Aeschylus or Shakespeare, we ever imagined. The creature is rising up against its creator. At once the microcosm, man against nature. So now the microcosm, machine, is revolting against Nordic man. The lord of the world is becoming the slave of the machine, which is forcing him, forcing us all, whether we are aware of it or not, to follow its course. The victor, crashed, is dragged to death by the team. So there's this inherent tragedy in man who, by his own, well, of a Nordic man, or a Northern European man in particular, who he feels compelled to constantly expand, to seek ever new greater horizons. And as a response to this, it has essentially been our downfall. It's essentially destroyed us, because in doing so, in our constant need for greater expansion, for greater learning, greater knowledge, we've created machines and technology that have ultimately gone against our nature and destroyed us. And again, back to the previous example, look at the fruits of this. Look at the world around us with globalization, with multiculturalism, with transgenderism, with the normalization of homosexuality and paedophilia, all these particular ills of the West just seems to have undermined our very sense of being.
Well, I certainly agree that those things have done that. I'm just not sure of the connection between them and the Faustian drive. I mean, why does multiculturalism, I would suggest that multiculturalism, I mean, I understand how it relates to, I don't actually understand how it relates to the Faustian drive. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, it is a Faustian drive. Essentially, our civilization, it constantly seeks to occupy limitless space. But this limitless space, as a civilization seems to decline and crumble, just becomes this all-consuming void that conquers everything. It essentially destroys all native traditions. It seems to, in its transgression of boundaries, it removes boundaries. It seems to liquefy everything and turn it into this this borderless mess. Because we're constantly trying to transcend the world and to transcend nature, and in doing so, it's broken down those natural boundaries. It's broken down these natural differences and divisions in the world. And in terms of our Faustian need to explore and expand, that can be seen as a good thing, because overcoming those limits are how we've achieved many of the great achievements of the West. But at the same time, once those boundaries have been removed, there's nothing concrete left. In order to overcome them, we have to liquefy and merge them.
I see what you mean. So yeah. You're saying that multiculturalism arises because of our drive to conquer boundaries.
Yeah, well, when transgressing like national boundaries, all these differences between these different people seem to be erased. They seem to be brought into the fold of our own achievements. So, as a result, as we've learned new skills, new technologies, we feel this sense of trying to improve the world, not in the same way as the Jewish Tikkun Olam, which is their view of trying to fix the world. But we feel this sort of need that all our great achievements, all our great technological inventions, we can just travel to new places in the world, help these people out with our general liberal mindset and generosity. With a small reference there to Kevin MacDonald's view that we are innately individualist and liberal in our own inherent natures, which just seem to overlap with this Faustianism. But doing so, we seem to believe that we can take everyone in the world under our fold, and that we can improve their lives. And we've given the world industry, we've given them liberal democracy. And in turn, it's essentially led to a form of system that's no longer something that we can control. It's beyond our control now. And this global technological machine has transcended our own creation. It's like a general tool of technology, which there's three stages to technology. I forgot what the other two are, but the first one is called the organon, which is any form of tool, which is something that you control, like a tool that you can wield for a particular purpose. The second stage is something in which the technology becomes part of you, like a sword or a weapon, for example. It's something that is an extension of yourself and your will, rather than something that's entirely separate, but it also seems to have a will of its own that acts alongside you. But then you get the third stage, which is when the technology itself, you become subject to it, which is the state of the world we're in now. I'll flesh that out a bit later when talking about how things have accelerated under COVID and under the past 2 years. But this development of technology, initially as a tool, it's no longer a tool. We seem to have exported all our techniques to the world, and it's created a system that is now replacing us, and we're no longer in control of it.
Well, yeah, I think that's certainly true. I think that part of the problem is we think functionality is what matters. Success is what matters. And we forget about all other priorities. So if we can feed these million Africans, then that's important, and other things that would be negated by that aren't important.
Yeah, well, in the past, a lot of things we had were constrained within particular limits. Things were bound to customs of a particular people and only had meaning when they were within the morality of a particular people and their boundaries. But because of the Faustian drive, this is one of the main descendants of Faustianism is globalism and universalism, because these are rooted in that need to constantly fill ever new open space. But this particularism of values and meaning, and rooted within a particular confines, has now extended to the whole ends of the earth, where we have to occupy every single space, we have to conquer everything, but also we have to export everything. And while in the past, the glorious achievements of the world were what we'd built, our civilization, our literature and language, the flip side to that is that this has now transformed into Globo Homo, but it's still being distributed in the world. It's still being shared. It's still being pushed by that same Faustian drive. So everywhere in the Middle East has to have liberal democracy. It has to have LGBT rights. And it's almost like a part of our nature has gone wrong.
Definitely for individual people, for ordinary people, this is not Faustian. This is not a drive to expand and explore anymore. It's maybe in the likes of the oligarchs and technocrats. For them, this is I can understand that drive being involved in all of this, because for them, they are exploring and expanding and conquering problems and working out new solutions and so on.
But that's the very problem. It seems to be driven by that. It seems to be driven by that same driver, by that same push. And just because it's inverted what its values are, just because we're not exporting the glory of the Western achievements, or we aren't pushing our cultural achievements on the world, it's taken a new form, but it's still being enforced on the world through that same mechanism. And that same mechanism is that that Faustian drive to expand. It's the same justifications we give for why the Middle East needs butt sex, just because it's a bit something that we have to occupy that space. It's something that we need to give them, because we think that this Faustian drive is very much bound up into the idea of progress, because in place of occupying physical space, it now has transformed into occupying ideological space, and thus there's always a constant. Everything transforms into a problem which needs to be fixed, and that's a definite issue.
You can see this with the WEF, the World Economic Forum. Their infographics that they put out are always about problems and solutions. This is a problem, here's our solution, endlessly. I mean, they are upset, they do seem quite obsessed with this idea that, well, everything is an opportunity to, every problem is an opportunity for us to find a solution to it. It's almost like they thrive on that. And of course, I'm no fan of the WEF, just to be clear. But is there anything else that you'd like to say on this point before we progress to the last 2020?
Yeah. Well, there's a very particular like a model of seeing this that was because a lot of the products of postmodernism do seem to come from this Faustian drive, and that might seem a bit counterintuitive in some ways, but in A Thousand Plateaus, which is authored by Deleuze and Guattari. They seem to have this analogy of describing things as a rhizome. And a rhizome is the root from a shoot of a small seedling, which constantly expand into the soil and just keep stretching further and further outwards. So this constant expansion of the roots of the seed as it takes hold have to occupy more and more space as it expands in order to grow. And there's a particular point which was in a very excellent Countercurrents article called Contra Faustian Man. And that was written by Eugene Monsalvat. But
that's one for people to look out for. I'll see if I can find it and link it in the chat.
Ah, brilliant. But yeah, in that, he writes about this rhizome analogy, about how the tree, a tree seems to represent the verb of to be. The meaning of a tree is essentially just a tree. It is something in itself, but the rhizome represents the grammatical conjunct and. It seems to point to this constant need of where something cannot just be itself. It needs to be something more but beyond itself. And in turn, this undermines being itself. There cannot be solid concrete categories in the world. There cannot be just a tree for the purpose of being a tree. It has to be something else. It has to have a particular purpose. It has to be a tool. And that points to things like Heidegger with the nature of something which has a being in itself, but also things which become a functional tool, which goes... I forgot the term that Heidegger used. Something about something to hand. But either way, every sort of transformation of any particular object, any particular being, it can no longer be something that stands alone as itself. It always has to have it always needs a purpose. And in the world of a global economy, can no longer be anything which can be in itself. It has to be commodified. It has to be transformed into having a meaning within that system that can have some monetary value. And as a result, this seems to undermine the value of the world in itself by turning everything that is static, that is real, that is rooted in reality into something that's dynamic. It seems to undermine concrete identities and make everything relative or liquidized. And in doing so, that's where postmodernism comes from. It seems to take away the suchness or being of things in the world, which only have meaning as far as they can be part of that constant expansion and progress. And as a result, it makes everything into a form of abstraction, especially in things like mathematics, and it expands what's real into the possible. And while this seems to have some positive connotations, like if you go beyond what's possible, that can lead to amazing achievements, amazing conquests, because we're always trying to surpass the impossible by going into space, by conquering mountains and things like that. But it also, on the negative side of this, it seems to undermine what is possible and what's real by unrooting things and making things a abstraction, which is the case with mathematics. It seems to over-intellectualize things and remove things like natural instinct and vitalism and replace it with a form of idealism. Like a lot of our experiences in the world as a result of living in this modern age, D.H. Lawrence calls it thought form. So we no longer walk through the woods and be able to feel the trees around us. We can't look at the sun and have this sense of connection or feeling to it. It's so far away, it's so abstract that we can intellectualize it, we can think of it in a abstract way, but it no longer feels connected. And this is part of the very problem which drags me towards these politics and these views I have in the first place. It was a feeling of nihilism. It was a feeling of alienation and depression in the world, and going, something's wrong in the world. Something just doesn't feel right. Why do I feel this sense of alienation and detachment from the world? And that seems to have brought me to where I am now, trying to find answers to that question as to what's gone wrong with the world. And one of the conclusions that I came to was that the modern world has removed us from our own natures. We're no longer in touch with what we are. We're constantly trying to become something beyond what we are. And it's we've lost any sense of instinct. And going back to Spengler, one of the main problems with things is things like antinatalism. And it's a very strange tragedy that that we of all animals are the only one that has to have a has to have some intellectualized justification for why we should reproduce, for why we should have to exist. Every other species on the world, even down to microbes and parasites, every insect in the world, every animal, it doesn't need to justify, it doesn't need to rationalize why it has a right to exist, because it doesn't need to. It exists by default of being what it is. And all of a sudden, we're entrenched in this fictional web of intellectualization, where we have to constantly talk in terms of theory, in terms of politics, in terms of philosophy, in order to explain why we should be doing things that every animal doesn't even have to ask that question. It just does. And Spengler writes in The Decline of the West, Volume 2, Chapter 4, when the ordinary thought of the highly cultivated peoples begins to regard having children as a question of pros and cons, the great turning point has come, for nature knows nothing of pro and con. Everywhere life is actual, reigns an inward organic logic, an it, a drive, that is utterly independent of waking being, with its causal linkages, and indeed not even observed by it. When reasons have to be put forward in a question of life, life itself has become questionable. And I think that's the main problem of why I'm seeing these net negatives in things like Faustianism. We seem to be removed from who we are. We seem to have to justify why we have a right to exist through rationalization. We seem to have to put forward arguments for why we should reproduce, why we should continue to be who we are. And we live in nations that are essentially invaded by another subspecies, which is competing for resources and reproducing at a massive rate. And in any other part of nature, you could watch a David Attenborough documentary about what these animals are doing and seeing how they're competing for resources. And you'd say, yeah, there's nature has this massive tribal warfare. It has a whole nature itself is bound in an eternal struggle and war. And here we are, humanity, having to talk around the issue in terms of politics. It's just absolutely absurd. We've lost any sense of who we are as animals. We've lost any sense of being grounded in nature. And instead, there's just this cold, sterile intellectualization that has destroyed meaning itself. So yeah, sorry to take things down to a very...
No, sorry, it's okay, don't worry. Do you think that intellectualization is bound to destroy meaning itself in the end?
I think it depends on what it's intellectualizing. It's like Using intellectualization as a tool can help to expand thoughts and help bring new ideas to things. But when everything becomes reduced to the abstract, including the including our own instincts, our own sense of agency, and our own sense of who we are, then that is a very negative side of things. I think the reduction of something which doesn't need to be intellectual, something which is which worked perfectly fine for hundreds of thousands of years on instinct alone, has in a very short time frame become reduced to a very empty, very vapid thing. It seems to have transformed that something that that we knew by instinct, that we didn't need to explain or justify, into a thought.
I guess the question here is, should things be justified? I mean, because you could say that animals just reproduce because they don't think, they don't consider, they don't evaluate, at least not intellectually. They're not capable of that. They act on instinct. Whereas yeah. Human beings uniquely have this ability to abstract things, to step back, to analyze, to contemplate. So of course, even our own decision to reproduce is going to fall under that.
I do get your point there. Yeah, in that case. I think what's changed there is an inversion of a hierarchy. Normally, when you have a hierarchy of these sort of things, you have this base level of that animal instinct, and then on top of that, above the animal instinct comes the intellectualization. What we've got now is a replacement of the animal instinct with the intellectualization. So there's no longer any foundation. So essentially, we have this. This artificial intellectualized framework, which isn't resting on anything at all. There's no natural foundation to who and what we are anymore. It's like it's like having this this superstructure, which doesn't exist on anything. And it's like the Emperor's New Clothes analogy. There's like there's nothing underneath it, and that's the problem that we're seeing a lot. Especially in the world today, when once this superstructure collapses, what's left? There's no foundation. There's nothing rooted. There's nothing natural underneath that anymore. There's just these empty bones of what once was, with a pristine. Sheet on top, which looks very effective. It looks very glamorous. But another analogy you could point at that is looking at a city. When you got all these big, massive skyscrapers, you've got all these wonderful products of history of industry that are producing fantastic things in the world, but what's the point if your rivers run dry, if your forests have all been torn down? There's no, and there's nothing to power this whole industrial framework. If you can't even do the basics anymore, then what's the point in having this extra layer of complexity on top?
Yeah, I think that's kind of key to it, that you start with a simple situation. You can marshal the different factors involved in that. Then one of those factors becomes more complicated, and it comes to dominate everything else, and you lose sight of the other factors. I think that's one way of looking at what's going on here. But it's a bit more exponential than that, because the thing that has grown and become very complicated and has its own momentum, and it wipes out, it subsumes the other things. So well, you end up with people who just talk about, for example, health, and they're obsessed with health. And we saw that a couple of years ago, to the exclusion of everything else. And you know, that's because there is a system in place to look after their health.
Well, it seems to be one of those issues that is subject to that part of that about the need to find problems in the world, which, as I said, is does seem to be ultimately as a result of this Faustian drive for better or worse, but the constant need to. Fix things which didn't need to be fixed, and it seems to have remodeled humanity, and it seems to subjugate normality into a pathology, because while previously in the past, you'd use medicine to fix a problem where one was ill and make them well. Now everything has been pathologized, so anything that is normal, anything that is beautiful, becomes a pathology, and it seems to have created a lot of effects that we get in the modern world, such as the contraceptive pill and abortion, which are attempts to overcome nature, because the whole point of doing so is to free up something that's previously natural in order to bring women towards the working world and industrialized world, and to help streamline labor, and to make them more effective. So it's a constant need for making things more efficient, making things more progressive, and all it does is it just seems to grease the wheels of industry and make things easier. But someone like that always has the question attached to it. Why? What's the point in this? And that seems like a very a simple thing to tack onto that, because, of course, you can give plenty of answers to it, but ultimately, it seems to reduce everything down to this core problem of what is the point in doing so? Well, in greasing the wheels of the economy, if the economy is to have things which allow you to live lives where you can raise your family, have a culture, have a people, and survive. But this, once you strip off all these husks of and layers of ideological baggage, or like culturally illusory baggage, you essentially get to the root of things and the matter of things. Of ultimately, we are a very natural, organic, animal, biological species that wants to reproduce, raise our family, live in small communities, and all of a sudden we have this very artificial infrastructure that we've built, which not only makes all these things easier, but has actually replaced what those things are now. So what was the point of developing a new technology? Initially, when you have a new technology, it's to make your work life a lot easier. But now we have machines and technology that have replaced us. We have things that create these almost mocking imitations of what we do. We've created things like essentially we've undermined any sense of purpose in how we live and what we do. Because they aren't pushing towards that that more primal biological goal. And I don't know if there's a problem in how working towards that primal biological goal somehow seems beneath us, that things like trying to build rockets so we can expand and go into space, and again, I'd re-ask that question. Why? How does that help our species? How does that help us survive? How does that help us reproduce our race and continue on that fundamental biological level? It's just... It's pointless faff.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. Obviously, this is a key problem of this age. We know how to do things, but we don't know why to do things. And I mean, if you were to ask someone 2 years ago, well, why do you want to survive COVID? Why do you, does it matter that that you're still here a year from now? I guess they would say, because I have a life to live. They would come up with reasons. They would have reasons to survive. But I think if you were then to say, okay, then, well, why should this black person, why shouldn't they have your stuff? Why shouldn't they have your town? I think as soon as it's a level abstracted, then things fall away. They don't know. They can't justify it. Well, yeah. why shouldn't this African refugee have everything that we have? No matter how much it inconveniences us, no matter how much it ruins our way of life, there's nothing more important. I think that people have this idea of survival sort of in and of itself, just on a biological level, really. As long as I'm biologically still here and still alive, then everything's great.
Yeah.
But I think when push comes to shove, that quickly, it's not enough.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of the problems of where this whole abstract idea of humanity comes in. Because when you're more than happy to see your own people replaced, because, well, as long as someone else exists to take my place, that's perfectly fine, because we're all humans at the end of the day. Or you seem perfectly happy to settle for something very, very unnatural and artificial, because at the end of the day, as long as I'm still here, that's fine. These are like two sides of a common problem that that this abstract view of us seems to cause. The view that as long as humanity continues to exist, where it's perfectly fine if we become wiped out and become replaced because humanity is the goal. It seems to have this very abstract veneer over the top of it, rather than seeing the world almost from a anthropological point of view, that why would any other species in nature allow that to happen to their own particular subspecies?
Well, this is an interesting one, because on the one hand, you've got the drive during COVID was, we all want to get through this, basically, you know, we want to survive. But then you've got something like the recent thing in Canada, where they're offering euthanasia for ridiculous reasons, like you're depressed.
Yeah.
Or you can't do the X or Y, or the medical treatment for this would be a bit expensive. Maybe just end it all now and leave your family with some money. This is so in other words, during COVID, we all were meant to behave as if survival at all costs was necessary. But then just 2 years later, survival actually doesn't matter. So what I'm getting to here is, this: on the one hand, there is this biological drive to survive, and that still exists today. But on the other hand, because there's no metaphysical or spiritual justification for your survival, actually your survival is very much up for grabs. It's very much open to negotiation. You might just want to end it all.
Yeah, it's the old switcheroo of dangling the importance of life when it can be used for political purposes, and then at the same time rendering it as meaningless as it was to these same elites. when it's convenient for them. And yeah,
I suppose that brings us to the matter of COVID, which I think you wanted to speak about as a separate chapter, really. What do you think? And this is really what I wanted to ask you, because you didn't appear last year. I don't think I knew if you I must have known if you in 2020. But either way, this is your first time on Millennial, and it's your first time since COVID, naturally. So I wanted to ask you the question, what has happened in the world? What has happened to us since March 2020?
With the whole COVID thing, I think for the first month and a half, I did buy into it. I was especially because I saw it as being, it might help to show the problem of how dependency on globalism is a problem, especially when you saw things like the whole food shortages, everyone was buying up toilet rolls and nonsense like that. But because of, there was a thing of how we didn't, we've lost control over our own production. We no longer, we import most of our food. We don't have a greater control over.
You just made me think of Liz Truss saying, we import of our pears. Go on.
Sorry. But yeah, essentially, this sort of dependency on the global economy. Once the whole world shut down because of the COVID scare, for me, this seemed to be, this is an interesting projection of how global dependency is bad for us. Hopefully, there will be something good to point out the importance of nationalism, of independent sovereignty, and being able to have control over our own nations, because clearly these once international connections and international trade shuts down, the whole world grinds to a halt. So I thought, this would actually be quite interesting, and as a result, I thought that its consequences would be in our favour. So at the start, I thought that it was a genuine pandemic, because a lot of the things did seem to suggest that. But it was only within about a month that everything just fell apart entirely. That I was seeing how fake the entire thing was. Saw the statistics popping up, and I've got to thank Dan from the Fergan as a good friend who made me aware of a lot of things, not only a lot of the statistics and things going around, but the ideological background to things as well. So he filled in a lot of the gaps, and that was a massive rabbit hole to go down to flesh out the things of this. So throughout the past 2 years, I've essentially just been ploughing on with things, living as normally as I can do. But it's a very strange thing, because it's a very one-sided situation, because you can say, I continued to live normally during COVID. But how can you do that when other people around you aren't? It's a very one-sided situation where you're trying to be as normal as you can, but everyone around you isn't, and they just aren't playing ball. So so while you can claim that that we try to be normal and carry on as possible, it's a very limited range of what you can do in that situation. But what I found very interesting, and what's quite particular to my interest in all this, was the whole digital infrastructure that was building around COVID, with the digital ID systems that were being brought into place, how COVID was a foot in the door for that, the transfer from a cash economy to a digital economy, and a central bank digital currency that can be centrally controlled. But also the dehumanizing aspects of the settings around it, like the wearing the masks and tricking people into complying with all the regulations and laws around that. But what was one of the worst effects with all of these factors combined is the dehumanization of people. It went even further away from a lot of these issues that I've been talking so far about, this what we've been discussing already, the denaturalization of things, how we seem to have stepped outside of our own nature. And the past 2 years have accelerated every single problem a thousandfold. We seem to have...
I agree. And this is another reason it annoys me when people say it's all over now. I just don't feel that it's over. Well, not in any sense that matters. You know, obviously, it's over, but there are these... it's changed everything.
Yeah, all the after effects have remodeled how people live. They've retreated from the real world and essentially become avatars of themselves on the internet, where most human interaction now takes place. There's no real life communities. There's no real life interactions. The communities that people have in their local village, even in their local city, have all broken down. All the high streets have all broken and disappeared because their businesses can't afford to stay open, and they lost lots of business during the lockdowns, and now they can't even afford to have the fuel and energy because of everything going on with the Russian-Ukraine war, which I won't speak much about because that's better left to Semyagog and others who have spoken well on that issue. But all the after effects of all this have left people without businesses, except when it's online delivery and things like Deliveroo and Uber and Amazon and this whole wealth transfer around it. It's essentially, it's taken away any elements of roots and grounding in the real physical world and abstracted them. And as far as power itself is concerned, it's just centralized entirely. And it's shown how many of the international powers in the world aren't as competitive with each other as they appear to be. They seem a lot more connected by global networks. And this seemed to blindsight a lot of people over the past few years, because a lot of us didn't even know about things, or we'd underestimated things like the World Economic Forum and the United Nations and World Health Organization. All these NGOs were all connected with national governments in ways that we couldn't have even foreseen years ago. And because of this,
that this was revealed, and it was amazing and frightening.
Yeah, but like the scale of this massive centralized network of power only seemed to further deroute people and take them out of the physical world, take them out of nature. And along with this, there was the things like the mass immigration, which accelerated even more, and a push towards things like smart cities and even further urbanisation. What I've noticed quite interestingly is almost like a restructuring of the entire world. Have you seen the second Blade Runner film? They'd won a 2049.
I'm afraid I still haven't seen it.
Ah, you need to get on with that. It is good.
I basically know the storyline.
Yeah. Well, at the start of it, as the camera's panning across, there's these big open farms of where which is like a sort of just a big massive field of lots of mass agricultural farming, which is completely uninhabited, but it's used for farming protein. And these have various different forms, which could be bugs and insects and things like that. But there's also no natural wildlife at all. In fact, there's a point made about this this dead flower, which the main guy, what's his name's character?
Ryan, whatever.
Yeah.
let's just call him Ryan.
Yeah. Ryan, who's also a replicant. He finds this small dead flower, so he keeps it with him. But no one seems to even know what it is. There's actual biological life, and trees and flowers and plants are so distant at this point in the future, because the whole world is dried up and dead, that people can't even recognize a flower. No one has any idea what it is. But it's this whole view of the all these fields of farming, and it's like it's almost like Dune, where the entire planet is used for harvesting the spice. And this sort of remodeling of the world seems what's going on now, where certain parts of the world will be used for the production of food and farming, especially if they can be taken over by global NGOs. Meanwhile, all the inhabitants will all be funneled into one particular area of the world. So essentially, you get all the Africans out of Africa, bring them into Europe, and then use Africa as farming space, or do the same with Asia or something like that. So essentially, you're remodeling the world in terms of, here are the living zones where everyone's all living together in a global mass. Here are the food production zones. Here are the technological zones. And it seems to remodel and restructure the world, rather than being a place full of people, different peoples occupying their particular regions of the world. You've now got everywhere remodeled and restructured in terms of zones of the economy.
Because they think that's going to be more efficient and functional and streamlined.
Exactly. It sees efficiency, it sees the economy as the highest goal. So everything becomes restructured and remodeled around that particular goal. And this is the point I made earlier about how something just can't be, like a tree can't be a tree in itself. It has to be it has to be an and. It has to be something more. It has to be part of this chain of progress. It has to go towards this goal of production and food.
I remember about halfway through this year, Morgoth wrote an essay on Substack where he talked about the possible disappearance of the Rhine River.
Yeah, and that was horrifying.
And he made the point that, what can modern man say about this? What modern man can only say, well, the Rhine is economically useful, therefore we need it, therefore we should want it to remain, and therefore we should maybe even do things to help it remain, because it's economically useful. That's the only metric by which a materialist can evaluate something.
Exactly. There's no need for things to be things in themselves. There's only the need to drive the economy. And you see a river like the Rhine. And it's not only just the nature of the river and the things that live in it, but it's spiritual meaning. The fact that most ancient societies had developed around particular rivers, and they'd find something sacred about that river. They'd find a sense of nourishment, a sense of their own identity and who they are, because it was something which gave life. And there's so many forms of poetry and plays and opera that have been written about the River Rhine. And all of that just is stripped of meaning entirely because it's just a flowing piece of water. And I think returning to the start point we began to talk about, I think that within that pagan worldview, there is a a view of the particular and difference, each having their own. Each having their own existence in themselves rather than being part of something else. But that spiritual attachment to the world of seeing that not only beauty, but something divine within the world around you.
Yeah, I think that's the crucial thing here, that there is no meaning. I mean, I can imagine a materialist saying, well, the Rhine is it's pleasant, it's nice, it's pretty,
yeah.
That's a good reason. All right, that's a good reason, as well as the economic benefits. It's just it's so bereft. I mean, do you value this thing or not? Is it, and I guess this is the point, it's that the Rhine is not meaningful to a materialist, and it depending on how far you take materialism, it cannot be meaningful to you. It can only be economically significant or not economically significant, or a spectrum there. But that's it. So if some other means of transporting goods or whatever became available that was better than the Rhine, then the Rhine becomes redundant. It becomes meaningless. It becomes valueless.
Yeah.
I mean, this is obviously a very impoverished worldview to have. I mean, it just surprises me how people don't feel that things are meaningful. To me, I'm not trying to puff myself up here, and indeed some would say that this isn't even a good characteristic for me to have. But for me, things just seem innately meaningful. Almost everything does. So it sort of baffles me how other people end up in this position where they're having to judge things on an economic basis or a utilitarian basis. I don't really understand how that. I mean, how can you not care about whether a river exists or not, especially one that's so culturally significant and so on? But even I went back to my hometown a year ago, and there was this place, a restaurant that had a car park, and the car park, it was in the middle of a forest, and the car park was surrounded by trees, big conifer trees, and they'd all been cut down. All of them.
Oh, that's horrible.
I mean, the car park used to be sort of sheltered by these huge trees, so there was no particular reason for doing this. It was just the way that they'd decided to build the car park in the first place, which was about, I don't know, early 90s probably. And it was always really nice. It was lovely. And they just leveled the entire thing. That landscape is now, well, I'd say it's completely different, but another way of saying it is that landscape doesn't exist anymore. The landscape that I knew is now non-existent.
That's horrible, but just the transformation of it all.
Yeah.
And again, that sort of, that car park, you have to ask, why is the car park being built? And someone will give you an answer of so people can park there. But when you say, yeah, but what's the importance of having the cars parked there? Well, it's so it helps business.
To be clear, it was always a car park. Like, it was built about 30 years ago, and it was fine, and that's how it was. So it was a sort of darkened. It was a car park that was darkened by these huge trees all around.
Ah, gotcha, gotcha.
And now, for some reason, it's still a car park, but for some reason, they've just got rid of all the trees. So now it's just, well, I don't know. It's just an area with tarmac on it, and that you know, you can still park cars, but it's like, you know. And I understand where you were going there. Like, what's the importance of parking? But why? I don't know. The point I was making was I felt really shocked when I saw it a year ago. I was really shocked. I was like, I couldn't understand why have they done this, and why didn't they value the thing as it was?
And, do you think do you think things like this, for the importance of doing something like that, is to is a deliberate to make people feel more alienated, and to make them feel more cold, less connected?
I really wonder sometimes. You know, I've even been, and this won't be your kind of thing, but I've been following a Telegram channel that posts lots of photos of London from the past, called Forgotten History UK. I keep plugging it during Millennial because it's I only discovered it about a week ago, but it's really, really good. And there, it's like every day, dozens of photos of old London from the 1890s and the 1920s and the 1950s. And it's amazing. But you realize that wherever you go in London and see a modern building, before that modern building was built, there was an old building there. And that hadn't quite clicked with me until I saw this Telegram channel, because it's full of photos of streets that have been demolished, streets that do not exist anymore. They don't even have the same name. Like the land has now been completely, some other street is there now. Some building has been demolished and some new thing exists in its place now. There's this sense that, well, I realize, okay, so wherever there is a modern building, it's not that there was empty land there before. It's that there was something beautiful was there before, which was destroyed so that this modern monstrosity could be put up in its place. And to get to your point, clearly after the war, after World War II, there was obviously a drive, especially in councils in Britain, to basically erase the past. And I suspect that it was quite overt. I suspect it was quite literally that. Rather than just convenience or whatever, I think they literally wanted to erase the past. And because they did it even with buildings that were obviously beautiful and obviously salvageable. Like the one that perhaps the most egregious example that people often use is Birmingham Library. Birmingham Central Library is this lovely Victorian building. The original had burned down, I think, in the 1860s. They'd built this huge one to replace it in the same location. And then, as far as I know, for no real reason, they demolished that in the early 70s, 1970s, and put up a concrete monstrosity in its place that everyone always hated. And that has now been demolished and replaced with something that, honestly, I think is even worse.
Well, as you can tell from my accent, I grew up in the West Midlands. So I spent a lot of time going to Birmingham later on in life, because I spent a lot of time in the suburbs and countryside when I was younger, which is very nice to experience that and have a decent upbringing. But later in life, I'd travel out to Birmingham. And spend a lot of time in the museum. And the museum is directly opposite the library. And the museum still has... Well, the town hall has a very neoclassical style. Like, it's... and it's also part of the main square of the town hall around there as well. And they had some very... quite nice neoclassical style architecture around there. But the library itself behind it... although the 70s was before my time, I'd see photographs in the museum about the old town of Birmingham and see what it used to look like. And
just I've got them now. I can show people. This is the nightmare that's there now, which I think is just hideous.
Horrible.
It's just awful. I mean, it's not as bad as some modern contemporary buildings, but it's still dreadful. The brutalist one that was there before is this.
That's the one that I'm used to.
Well, yeah. And but the in order to build that, they demolished this. And, you know, I just, to get to your point, finally, do they do this to disorient people, to confuse them, to deracinate them? I think the only answer can be yes.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, why would you? Why on earth? How could you, by accident, replace that with this?
Whoops!
I don't know how you could do that and think this is better. How on earth? And you know, everyone knows I've got a certain fondness for brutalist architecture, but I mean, just in a sort of artistic sense, how on earth could you think that that is better than that? I don't know how any sane person with a pair of eyes could possibly reach that conclusion. Of course, we say reach that conclusion. That gets back to what we were saying earlier, that this shouldn't be something that you need to analyze.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just quite instinctual. Is that that is better than that. I guess there is a debate to be had about whether that is better than that, but I think it probably is, actually. I mean, at least this is sort of insultingly decorative. At least this is honestly utilitarian.
Yeah, it's a utilitarian, but also quite imposing as well. It's like with a sort of
it's
obviously not ornate. It's obviously not beautiful, but there's a sense of imposing power about it that you can try to appreciate in some sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I mean, again, maybe it's to do with when we grew up that a lot of buildings were brutalist when we were small. It was sort of like the default building.
Yeah.
So maybe we have a certain acceptance of it, even fondness for it, certainly on my part, that is not well placed. But nonetheless, I don't think this is as bad as this. I think that this is... there's just no way into that. At least with this, you can say, oh, it's a bit soulful, it's a bit evocative or whatever. This is just not. It's just nothing. And, you know, it's a weird thing about modern architecture that it seems to evoke nothing but either alienation or confusion, but never warmth, never coziness, never something nourishing.
You know what I really hate about that? It's smugness. There's something just really... I was like, you know, the architect who built that, he's just grinning from ear to ear with this shit-eating grin. And he looks at that and he feels that he's made an artistic achievement. He looks at that and he feels that he's poured some sense of creativity and character to it. And that sense of smugness and pride that he feels just feels... on the inverse of it, sickening. At least with the brutalist one, there's some sense of functionality to it. But no one was feeling smug about that. But there's definitely something really just horrible and spine-tinglingly horrible about that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree. But, I mean, just to recap, we are talking about a site that originally had that.
Yeah, so that's the thing. It's like anyone can see that and they can feel the architecture. They can walk past it. They feel a sense of place. They feel a sense of identity, a sense of belonging to it. There's something very particular about it, but also a sense of rootedness and belonging to it. And imagine some, those architectural revival pages, like the one on Twitter that constantly post the comparative architecture.
Yes.
There'll be some smug leftist who will who reply to that and just go, "Well, I can't see the problem. This is it's just two different, like, there's no hierarchy in their view of the world. There's no sense of of the sublime and beautiful. Instead, they'll say, "Well, it's just a different form of architecture. How can you really argue why one is better?" And essentially, to engage any sort of argument with such a person, you'd have to accept his terms, and then essentially you get dragged into having to justify and explain why it's better. But again, you shouldn't even have to explain to such a person.
I wouldn't waste my time. See, in 2013 and 12, and 14, I wasted a lot of time on Facebook debate and getting into really involved debates with people. And, you know, some videos did come out of that grueling experience in the end for my channel. But ultimately, I think it was a waste of time. Nowadays, I just treat such people with... I honestly do. I just, like, no. Oh, you don't get it? All right, maybe next time.
Yeah.
I'm not going to kowtow to these morons.
It's just the eternal hatchling who has to constantly ask and just trying to draw you out into having to explain something that you shouldn't even... Well, but it defies words because you feel it. And it's that sense of instinct that the abstraction of the world has robbed of us. And yes. This is something that...
This gets to what we were saying earlier, that maybe... analysis ultimately ruins everything, or at least it can do. It's a weapon that can be used. It's a tool that can be used to do that. You can end up saying, "Well, I really don't know why the original Victorian building is better than the modern thing," because you can analyze it and say, "Well, is it the shapes? Is it the form? Is it the general tone? I really don't know. Maybe the modern one is better. Maybe they're equal. Maybe it's just different ways of building things. Maybe we're all entitled to our opinion."
Well, as a good segue into another topic of discussion, this is something that I have seen quite a lot with in terms of language. Because of this lack of hierarchy, there's the view that urban black vernacular that they speak. What's the London term for that?
Like, sorry, hold on. I just have to read out a funny comment that someone's just written. Gino Fano says, "Once upon a time, I watched Sargon of Akkad unironically." "It was only woe's exasperation that led me towards truth." So that's it's nice of you to say that. But on the other hand, I do feel sorry for Sargon. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted you to read out that amusing comment.
Oh, no worries. What's the term that's used for, like...
It's either Ebonics or Multicultural London English.
Multicultural London English, that's the one, yeah.
It's god-awful, absolutely awful accent.
But I've seen, especially within the fields of English language and linguistics, this view of a lack of hierarchy, the view that rather than seeing that multicultural... what was it again?
Multicultural London English, which is awful sort of Jamaican.
It just sounds a very forgettable phrase. So sorry about that. But with this multicultural London English, that it's not a bastardization of English. It's not a vulgar decay of something once beautiful. It's just another form of English. It's just something that, a very patronising way, they'll say it's equal to your English. It's just another form, and that just really riles me up.
Sorry. Well, I mean, you see, this is the trouble. It's something that has emerged naturally, disregarding the fact that mass immigration is not natural. But let's leave that aside. Once the people are there, the accents are naturally, inevitably going to merge. And this is what really disturbs me. You know, you could have a nice, well-raised white child and you've taught them to speak properly and all that. And then you send them to a state school in London and all of your work is just pissed down the drain. You know, it's because they have to acclimatize. They have to align with the majority and they have to not sound like they think they're better than everyone else, which means sounding black.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just it's a good example. It's a good sort of manifestation of what has been done to us, that we've been put in this position where we have to align with other peoples, let's say, or get destroyed by them because they'll hate us for not aligning with them. I mean, I feel so sorry for any kid in a multicultural area.
Yeah. This is definitely something that I saw when I was living in Birmingham, just the first-hand decay of it and just seeing communities around me just collapse in real time. But on the issue of multicultural London English, it's the attack against prescriptivism, of the idea that there's no such thing as a high form of language. It's like I'm very interested in linguistics. I'm very interested in languages, especially ancient languages, as the little plaque on the bottom of the screen says, archaeolinguist. I'm very interested in ancient and dead languages, but especially my own native form, of its earliest incarnation in Anglo-Saxon Old English, which is where my name Whityard comes from, meaning white yard, or a white enclosure, or a space or enclosure for that is white. So feel free to interpret that how you wish. But obviously, languages change over time. They develop and they take on many new elements around it. But I do think that shouldn't mean that all forms of decay over time can be classified as just as equal to its previous form. You can't read writers like Edmund Spenser or Shakespeare, which are very archaic in modern English, and feel that there's that's equal to everything modern that you see. And it's a comparative thing to put towards architecture as well. This idea that all later developments are just another form of it, that prescriptivism within architecture is immoral or wrong in any way, and that naturally evolves. Obviously, all these changes have been very unnatural, but seeing the change around it as being something that is perfectly acceptable, and we should just accept the development of it as being just how things are. And that's the problem with phrases like, well, the times are changing, rather than seeing it in the... it's using the passive voice to just accept things that are being done in a very active way. The times aren't changing. The times are being actively changed by evil people with evil intentions for us.
Yeah, I think this is a cope. It's a way of dealing with one's own lack of power over a situation. I mean, it tends to be, you know, well, what can your average person do about this? You know, well, the accents are changing, the architecture is changing. Most people know that they realistically can't do anything to stop that. So they have this phrase, well, it's just the way it is, or c'est la vie, or, you know, whatever kind of passive because most people are passive. I mean, it's unfortunate because you want them to have more agency. You want them to complain. You want them to have some power. But I don't know. I mean, what can even you and I do about it? I wish we could do something.
I know. Well, that's why it's more important to try to prevent this constant homogenization of things into a centralizing merge to stop the brown sludge of everything in the world. If you can find a way to separate from the system, to form communities where these particular differences they can be preserved independent of the effects of globalization, then that's something important to do to make sure that we can uphold traditions. And I know people like the Reaver. He's a very good commenter on folklore and traditions. And it just seems very important to make sure that everything that's particular to us doesn't become lost over time. That anything that is unique about how we sound, and especially how language reflects what's important to us. Why, like Scots is a, it's not just a dialect of English. It is technically its own separate language, just in the formal terms. Probably not around Edinburgh. That's probably still classed as a form of English. But I know that a lot of traditional Scots, because of its sound changes and how it uses things separately to English, it has enough qualifications to class as a whole sub feature of a whole a separate language to English.
See, because I mean, this is something that I've become quite ardent about over the last few years. Nowadays, if I were, you know, Emperor of Scotland, I would make sure I would have, basically, I would try to reintroduce non-English languages. You know, either Gaelic or I don't know, maybe Doric. I'm not sure. But I would want to settle in one that separated and distinguished Scotland from the rest of the world.
Exactly.
And ideally separated them from the rest of the world to some extent. And that very idea, I think, is anathema to the modern, to the kind of mindset that we are railing against. The idea that a people should be separated from the rest of the world and artificially separated, I think, would fill a lot of people with horror. But I think they should be.
Yeah, it seems that the two artificially separate, well, to deliberately choose to separate people from someone else, almost seems like you're stunting progress, you're stunting growth. But I guess to wrap up a lot of the things we've discussed here already is, what is the point of progress when it undermines who we are and it undermines what we are? The most important thing that we can ever try to save and try to work towards is the self-preservation of our own people and our ways of life, our traditions, our customs. And if that involves having to separate ourselves from the mainstream, from this global system, then it's more important to do so. We can't allow the constant brown sludge of merging the entire world together. We need to keep what's particular to us. And this is the point I was making about Scots, because Scots developed separately from Middle English as its own separate language. But now Scots is being brought back into the fold of being they're turned back into modern English again. So it's a lost that phase of being its own separate branch and being brought back into the main stem of that branch. It's losing that particular value to it. And what's important about different languages and dialects is that we use particular words, particular phrases, and particular ideas to express what's important to us. There's a reason that we use one word over another, even if they have a similar meaning. It's not just out of habit. It's because that word clearly resonated with us to describe some unique particular value and flavor that even though a similar word is functional in the same way, it's functionally similar, it doesn't capture those nuances, those unique unique character that a particular word can. And even those smaller details are why it's important to keep those things important, to keep those particulars alive. And all these things which can indicate and mark out what's important to us, and not to let them be swallowed by that all-consuming void, which I believe the Faustian drive will push towards. But that doesn't necessarily say that there's something bad about that Faustian drive, because it's brought us many wonderful cultural achievements, but at the same time, it will swallow everything, and that's why we need to temper it with a form of tradition. Rather than having than constantly expanding outwards, we need to have reproject that that Faustian drive into something meaningful that doesn't mean that we lose a sense of the particular and who we are.
Oh, I agree. I think that the Faustian drive, if it is not tempered, and I guess you could say that this about any obsession, if it's not tempered, then it becomes demented, it becomes crazed and destructive. It becomes scathing of anything that is not directly useful to it, directly relevant to it. And it destroys those things for just taking up space or getting in the way, being obstructions or whatever. So I think it is very important to have a sense of proportion. I mean, the thing is, the Faustian drive is a romantic notion, and people might well say that you can't really temper it. It's an extremely powerful thing. I think within an individual, that might be true. An individual will just become obsessed, go to the extreme, go to the absolute limit, burn himself out and all that. But when it comes to a group, I think there are more checks and balances that are possible and that should be there, should be implemented so that they don't get destroyed by this.
Yeah.
So I certainly agree with you there. So, all right. Well, I guess this is a good place to end the conversation. It's been a very good one, been an interesting one. So, so thank you, Whiteyard.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you very much for having me on. And thanks to everyone who's tuned in and listened to it.
Oh, I've just remembered there are super chats.
Oh,
right. There are a few. Dave Martell says, "Oh well, I'm going to have to send you this on Telegram, and you can perhaps read it out because it's in a strange language that I'm not conversant in." So there you go.
Ha! He says, "Which yard is based?" But
right, okay.
Sorry, but "based" is written in the Anglo-Saxon Fuddoch.
Ah, okay. So this is something that you could talk about perhaps next year. I could bring you on to talk in some detail about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But just now we're only touching on it, which seems a shame. I'm sorry about that. And then the Fergan, who was mentioned, I think, at least once in the conversation, says, "If imperialism and multiculturalism can be considered Faustian, might we also consider Europe's embrace of Christianity a Faustian blip in history?"
Yes.
Okay. Let's keep it short and sweet there.
Yeah.
And then,
I want to get into that sort of argumentation with things. And I thought I'd just keep the answer short. But yes, I absolutely agree with that point.
Okay. I thought so. And then Black Pigeon Pill says, "How did Whiteyard come up with his name? Was he inspired by Uncle Jared, or does it refer to some pagan term I'm otherwise unfamiliar with?"
When I first started the channel, I had the name in Old Norse, so it was Hvitgarður, spelt with a V instead of a W, and G-A-R, I mean, letter F, which is that D with a little line through the top, and R. So Hvitgarður would be the Old Norse version, and has exactly the same meaning, but... After two channels got shadow banned by Telegram, I learned my lesson of not being too spicy, and nice. Thus the third channel was called Hvitgarður, and third time lucky so far. But it's, essentially, it just means a white yard or a white enclosure. I wanted to have a name of a channel which reflected what my channel was about, what it concerns itself with, which is the well-being and the health of the European people.
Okay. All right. And then the Fargan comes back and says, how do Whityard and Woes think that COVID will affect the artistic capacity of European man? Are there already signs of a change in creative ability? If so, why? Let me answer this first. I think you've got to remember, I mean, stress, strain, fear, worry are creatively inspiring emotions and states of being. And while we perceive COVID as a con and a technocratic ruse, I think ordinary people were actually afraid of it, and so they perceive it as a threat and a cause of stress and strain and fear and worry. So I don't know. It's possible that it will actually inspire creative work. Ironically, this is a good example of what I've said quite a few times now, that our art, our music, our literature doesn't actually reflect life as it is. So it's possible that if somebody did, you know, was scared of, worried about COVID and public health and all that, and tried to create an artwork about that, it would be censored. It would be sort of cast by the wayside for being too meaningful, even though the meaning is misguided. It's possible that, because I think that modern culture, art, and so on, drama, seems to almost make a point of not addressing real life issues. It's ironic that. Yeah, but, what would you say about this? Can COVID affect the artistic capacity of a European man?
I think so. There's the issue, obviously, with how art will be made in the future, and you get things like AI art, which is a whole different topic in itself, but what the medium of art will be. But I mean, the real issue here is how effective how meaningful can art be that based on a lie? During the whole COVID thing, I was one of the people who denied the existence of COVID itself. It's like, rather than those saying that viruses don't exist and going down that sort of route, I was fully admitting that influenza was a real thing, that such viruses are perfectly natural, but that COVID was not a real thing. It was a rebranding and a renaming of influenza that was using the name to represent something which wasn't separate to a influenza. So, but around that, there was this, everything around COVID was a very fictional narrative, even down to the whole... even down to the fear that people felt around it. It was all something that was given to them by the media. And I just asked the question of how effective and how meaningful can art be that based on a lie that at some point in the future could just be stripped away.
But the thing is that art is still coming from a human being who thinks, I mean, to coin a phrase, COVID was real in his mind. So for him, it's real, weirdly enough.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see the point there. I'm just very, I think I'm very pessimistic about what art could be like from that, but built on such a very flimsy structure. But at the same time, I think art based as a response to COVID rather than art based around COVID, almost as if those who sought to flee from the issue and how they sought to react to the events of the past 2 years would be a lot more meaningful than those who bought into the narrative, if that makes sense. I think those who would react against it would produce something a lot more meaningful than those who react to it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I see what you mean, and I think you're right. But anyway, we really do need to wrap up now. So I'll be back in 5 minutes or 10 minutes with Bubba Kate. But in the meantime, Whit Yard, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, it's been a great conversation. So, I've enjoyed it. So, thank you. And, okay, I'll see you all imminently. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.